Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS, and I'm alongside food superstar, Thea Leonarduzzi. Hello, Thea.
Hello.
My dad listens to this podcast and they came up this weekend and they took my kids to Pizza Express, and my son, great little fellow that he is, wanted a Hawaiian pizza.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do Hawaiian pizza
at
Pizza
not.
Express. No. You'd think they might do, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I would.
But they don't. Which I think you'd approve of.
Yep.
My dad had a Veneziana.
Yeah.
Which has raisins in it.
Yeah.
Now, come on. Is that acceptable in the Italian mode? It sounds Italian.
Well, I mean, I don't like the sound of it, but
no.
You did mention this
earlier. It's got eggs, hasn't it? Eggs and raisins, I think.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't see anything about that, but I did. You mentioned it this morning, so
yeah.
I did.
You have investigated, good.
I have investigated. And it does exist. And it sort of makes sense for there to be raisins on it, because I suppose if you think of Venice, historically a meeting ground, you know, major port for where East meets West.
Okay.
And raisins would have been a quite luxurious at the time, expensive ingredient. So you'd also expect to find pine nuts, for example, which you do on this pizza.
Yeah.
I understand.
Veneziana
pizza. I don't like the sound of it.
No.
When I dug a little bit further, apparently the founder of Pizza Express, and this is not a promotion.
No, I don't believe you're a Pizza Express aficionado.
I will leave you to think what you will.
Yes, exactly.
But so the founder of Pizza Express invented the Veneziana sometime in the 70s in partnership with a conservation charity called Venice in Peril. And a portion of the proceeds from each of those Veneziana pizzas goes to this fund to, you know, save Venice, essentially. And it's raised so much money over the years and awareness.
Okay, here we go.
Apparently he has been made the founder, Peter Boizot, has been made a commendatore of the Ordine al Merito, which is the highest honour that you can be given by the Italian state.
Pine kernels, red onion, capers, black olives, sultanas, mozzarella and tomato.
Oh, it sounds horrible.
It does. But also, I feel that the snobs who cock a snook at Hawaiian pizzas.
Yeah, me.
You, yes.
Yeah. Say what you mean.
Yeah, I feel that's no different.
I don't really like the sound of either, although I do think that Hawaiian is a different
Sarah, our producer, thumb up or thumb down for Veneziana? Oh, thumb down.
Yes. Nice one, Sarah.
Well, I'm glad we've done the pizza bit. Here's the bit where I encourage you to subscribe to the TLS. Use this special offer code and get on board, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. All one word, podcast offer. It's the best price anywhere on the internet. 5 issues for £5 or $5. I'd like to think of people listening to this and going off and doing that. This week, we cautiously enter the world of science fiction with a vast, gleaming issue of Intergalactic Plenitude. And lots of other stuff too. Lucy Dallas, SF aficionado, has returned to her northern roots for the day. We couldn't let her escape, so she'll be on the line talking about one of her favourites, the 9-volume space opera by James S. A. Corey. From the extraterrestrial sublime back to Earth with a bump, the impeachment of Donald Trump. But what is the historical precedent for such a move going back to the Middle Ages, I hear you cry? Fear not, Lawrence Douglas will tell us. And much has been made of T.S. Eliot's recently revealed letters to Emily Hale. Well, the poet Hannah Sullivan has been to Princeton to look at them and will be reporting back to us. I once reviewed three big science fiction novels for the TLS back when I was a jobbing reviewer, and I did kind of enjoy them, but I felt perhaps I was missing out on something. So this week in the paper, we've had a very thorough exploration of the genre, from its early century gentlemanly origins, Wyndham and Wells, through the drug-inflected 1960s, to its more modern and perhaps more egalitarian incarnation today. Lucy Dallas has written about one of her faves, the space opera called The Expanse by James S. A. Corey, who she comes at by way of Ursula Le Guin, who may well be the mother of modern fantasy fiction. Lucy can tell us more and is on the line now. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, hi.
You're an interesting choice to talk about science fiction, because as we've just been discussing, you don't actually have a proper phone that takes email, apparently. So you're up to about 1980 in your own personal life, but in the world of fantasy fiction, you're well ahead in the future.
In theory, anything is possible.
Yeah, indeed. Right, before we get into The Expanse, you begin your review, lovely review, by the way, Lucy, on the stick versus the carrier bag theory of fiction.
Yes, which I would like to claim as mine, but it's absolutely not.
It sounds like nonsense.
No, it's not nonsense either. It was actually put forward by, she was a kind of anthropological historian, I think, called Elizabeth Fisher in the 70s, and that was about a theory of evolution.
Okay.
In that the first device, we often think of the first tool as being some sort of weapon, like a stick to bash things with or to bash animals or to make fire, whatever. But actually she suggests that it's a bag, a carrier bag, because if you go out foraging for food, you can put all the food in your bag, you can put the baby in your bag while you're out foraging for food. And Ursula Le Guin takes this in an essay she wrote in the 80s and says, what if that applied to fiction? She basically says, fiction is often sort of very directional. There's a hero, there's a thing to do, and the hero fights lots of people and then he does it. What if it was a bag? What if you put all sorts of things in it and they got all mixed up in it and the end wasn't so obvious?
And so even though it's a genre, and genre fiction is actually peculiarly stick fiction in some respects, because it tends to have plot as its major device and wants you to take you from A to B if you look at Westerns or you look at detective fiction. Actually, she's saying science fiction is kind of unusually capacious.
Yes, or it can be, and she very much likes that idea and wants to apply it to her own fiction, and particularly science fiction, because she says, in the bag you can have all the human stuff that you would have, you know, relationships, people not understanding things, but you can also have spaceships, missions, not successful missions that constantly get there, but missions that go wrong and people who misunderstand things, and then there's a transformation along the way and it all gets jumbled up. It's quite interesting to just think about lots of works of fiction and say stick or bag or a bit of both.
I tell you what, that's a game, isn't
it's
it
a game, yeah.
Stick or bag. So Tristram Shandy bag.
Absolute bag.
And I thought stick, Odyssey bag.
Okay.
More or less.
Even though Odyssey's kind of a directional journey that goes from A to B.
It's a long time.
Well, yeah, but it could be a long stick.
A very big bag.
Oh, very
a lot
long.
Of, trans-
very
deep lot of bag. Transformations along the way. Mm. A lot of shape shifting.
And why is this particularly true of science fiction? Is this because you actually got this quote, which is lovely, she's talking about science fiction, and she says, lugging this great heavy sack of stuff full of beginnings without ends, of initiations, of losses, of transformations and translations, and far more tricks than conflicts, far fewer triumphs than snares and delusions, full of spaceships that get stuck, missions that fail, and people who don't understand. Why is that true of science fiction? Apart from the ships, why is that not true of human life generally?
I think it is, but I think she was applying it to science fiction because, I'm guessing this now, I'm extrapolating, but that's what she wanted to do and did try and do in her own fiction. It, as I say, it's not only the sort of human dimension. Science fiction, I suppose, you could think about anything. You know, there are no boundaries on you.
Because there is some science fiction that wants to follow basic rules of physics, isn't there, as well, which means that not everything is possible. There is some science fiction that sort of imposes constraints on itself.
Yes, I'm not sure how recent that is. I mean, I was reading Robert Irwin's piece about the 60s science fiction, and it's very good, his piece, and very funny, and he says that sounds a bit like people can just do anything.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit more like sort of Bill and Ted. You can just pop up anywhere you want, and, you know, you can go anywhere you want, you can travel laterally in the blink of an eye, you're not bound by anything. It's more like magic, almost.
Yeah.
Whereas what they call hard science fiction, which of the recent people are people like Alistair Reynolds, who has worked at NASA or the European Space Agency for a while, and Kim Stanley Robinson and people like that, and this one that I've reviewed, you have to operate within the laws of physics as we know them. So you can't go faster than the speed of light, for instance.
But they do, like, when I read these books for the TLS, one was an Ian Banks book about The Culture, which is his sort of giant space kind of opera world that he's created. And one of the things that struck me was it's just full of what John Updike, who didn't like science fiction, called plenitude. It's just full of stuff. So this great heavy sack of stuff that Ursula Le Guin talked about was kind of literal. It was very shiny and full of tech and, you know, vast expanses and spaceships that were, you know, 5,000 miles long and everything was glinty and shiny. Is there a kind of techno-fetishism about a lot of sci-fi and science fiction? And if that's the case, do you like that side of it?
I think there probably is a bit of it. And with regards to it being big, I mean, not to be facetious, but space is quite big.
Is it? So space may not exist, a podcast we had earlier this year. It may be an imaginary.
Okay. It might be a nanoparticle.
Yeah.
But as far as we can tell, if we go with the old theory that space is quite big,
then
you do have to deal... The thing that I like about it, so particularly in The Expanse, let's say, not everything is glinty. Sometimes they're in an old spaceship and they're moaning because they've got no room. They're actually living on top of each other. It's as though they're living in a small house. You're in a spaceship for months at an end and you get the same food the whole time. And you've got to make sure the air recycler is topped up and you better make sure that nobody gets too annoyed with anybody else.
It's a bit like Red Dwarf. I read Red Dwarf books when I was younger. Is that science fiction, isn't it?
I'm afraid I don't know Red Dwarf.
I bet you don't
either. I've seen about 2 minutes of it, sorry.
I only know it as a TV programme. I had no idea that it came from...
Well, there are books as well. They may have written books off the back of the TV programme. But I quite liked it. But a lot of the thrust of it was you go a million miles in space and you end up as if you're still where you were because the same griefs and moans and sort of ordinary drudgery you've brought with you.
Well, except in The Expanse, and this is really interesting, you make the point that it's a sexism-free world that they're imagining. And I say they because James S.A. Corey is, in fact, two people.
Yes, he is. They've done this interesting thing because, you know, if it's a world in the future, you can do whatever you want. So there's been a lot of space exploration, and they seem to have, this is not explicitly stated, they seem to have got rid of any gender or sexual prejudice or problems. Nobody cares who sleeps with who. Nobody cares if you're a man or a woman. There are quite a lot of marriages where there are like eight people at once. But racism is still very much there based on which planet you're from, not what colour you are.
Is that kind of a metaphor?
I think that's just the way they've chosen to go. I mean, in a way, that's what I like about it. It's a thought experiment. All fiction is a thought experiment. But with science fiction, you can keep the human dimension. You don't have to, but, you know, like you were saying, you take your griefs and everything with you.
Yeah.
But you can also expand it out wherever you want. And so because racism is still there, from whether you come from Earth or Mars or an outer planet, and politics is still, of course, very much there, colonialism is there, the military is still there. There's a lot of very familiar things.
Does that put it in the centre of the culture war that exists? I'm struck by that. Roz Caveney was writing about that this week, where she's talked about some of the various problems science fiction has with its sort of relatively recent past, where it was very white, it was very male, and a bit unwelcoming to people of different backgrounds, and maybe that's changing. But actually, because it's has this theoretical possibility, and it can address big issues in whatever direction it chooses, it occurs to me that it could be particularly liable to get involved in a culture war because it's looking at culture in its broadest possible sense.
Yes, exactly. I think that is right. And it's not surprising that there have been a kind of fights and upsets going on in the science fiction world, as there are everywhere else. And the funny thing about it is that there was a strong strain of white, male, and frankly, rather racist writers. But there's always been the other stuff as well. I mean, there's always been people writing about all sorts of things that nobody else was thinking about at the time in terms of gender and race and ecology and, you know, all of those things. Recently, there were quite a lot of prizes named after some people with some pretty unsavoury views, and they were trying to get that turned over. And there was the whole thing, the sad, self-styled sad puppies tried to rig an awards list because they were fed up of the so-called liberal consensus. Though it didn't work because then most of the awards were not awarded that year, and now, actually, because of the spotlight on that, it's much more diverse than it was before. And a lot of brilliant stuff is being written about race and gender, but not just that, by very diverse set of writers.
Well, and it sort of seems to make sense in a way, because if sci-fi has sort of been, or SF has sort of been, a bit of an outsider genre, a bit, you know, pushed to one side, it would seem like a natural place for non-white male writers to really thrive.
Ross Kaveney also argues that Ursula Le Guin may be a bit old-fashioned, because we've gone past the point where sweet reason and renunciation will help us. So she sort of argued in the 60s she was this great dominant figure who wrote these beautiful books, you know, even in fantasy as well, like The Wizard of Earthsea, where there was a kind of kindness. And sort of Kaveney seems to be saying, actually, that's lovely, but we've gone well past kindness now.
Well, I don't think that's true. I mean, I know what she means, but I think if we say we've had enough of kindness and sweet reason, we've had it.
Yeah.
There's plenty of kindness in The Expanse. There's a crew of four that we really follow, and they go through all sorts of things, but there is plenty of connection.
Would I like it, Lucy? Would I? Because it struck me reading your review that it's a bit of a detective story. Is that fair?
It is.
Yeah. I like detective stories. I like sort of road movie type things. I like buddy things. I like, you know, what a naff sentimentalist I am. I like things where there's sort of narrative progression and people gang together and they do things in a plot-based fashion. Is this stuff I would like in these books?
I absolutely think so. I mean, for some people, they can't get past what... I remember I was talking to David Gregg about a stage show he did, and he called The Fremulator. Some people can't get past the kind of... Everyone's called Karg, or full of machines that you don't know the names of, but The Expanse is quite good at this. I see no reason why you wouldn't like it. And actually, the thing about the tropes that you're saying, it's a bit of a detective and it's a bit of this, is really interesting, because Ros Kaveney says in her piece, the tropes of genre, she's saying that the books use the tropes of genre in a cumulative way as literary gestures as much as plot points. And I think that is a thing that science fiction can do.
Will you bring me one in? Can you bring the first one in? The Expanse.
I've got eight.
Yeah, right.
Do they feel self-contained, or do you have to start at one and then does it finish itself in a way?
It probably does, but I'm not the right person to ask. I mean, I think it would probably catch you up pretty quickly. But I basically inhaled them after the first.
I love books, like, as you know, that's my dream. Yeah. I love finding a series.
I feel if you bring one of these in for Stig, Lucy, we might just not see him for months.
It's a win-win for everybody, isn't it?
I will bring it in.
You mentioned the sort of Karg thing. I was looking back at this review I wrote, and it's about this Banks book, and people's names were kind of deliberately, it felt to me, kind of looked like someone had dropped a Scrabble tiles and just picked up 14 of them in random, you know, sort of Krugerisness, Numenumina. And I wonder, actually, is that a deliberate thing? Because it doesn't want to be too... Is there a thing where, because it's not always been respected, because it's always maybe been a bit on the outside, is there part of it as a genre that is happy with that? It doesn't want to make itself too easy because it's kind of gloried in its outsiderdom.
I don't know about that. Maybe. But I do think... So in The Expanse, the crew are called Jim, Naomi, Alex and Amos. So you don't get to meet any Kargs for ages and ages and ages. And I find that happens more in the stuff that's being written now. There tends to be a lot less Kargness, because if you get five pages of it, it can be a bit...
It can be much, can't it? I just felt that I just don't want to see another name. It just feels like it's sort of self-evidently... It's almost sort of glorying in its silliness.
Silliness, I would dispute.
All right.
but yeah, maybe.
Thea, do you want to borrow it as well?
No,
she doesn't.
It does sound great. Yeah. I'm hesitant to commit to...
Shall I read it?
Nine books?
Yeah, there's nine of them.
Yeah, there are other things that I need to get to first. So
no,
I'll
there's
put
nothing
a hold
else
on that.
You need to do.
All right, Lucy, I promise on air now I will read it, because I love stuff like that. I love finding a new series.
Fantastic. The only danger is me forgetting to lend it to you, but I'll do what I can.
All right. Well, we've said it in public now, so it'll have to happen. Lucy, you've kindly joined us from the north. Is it cold there?
It's freezing sleet.
Is it really? Oh, proper weather.
Yeah, it is.
Is that nice, amazing, having proper weather?
It's dramatic.
Yeah, a bit cold.
Yeah, it is a bit cold.
Fine. Well, look after yourself, Lucy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, because you're not a lover of genre.
I don't really find it helpful to recognise it, to be honest.
God's
sake. I don't.
You have to. It's
well,
there.
No, but so, well, it is and it isn't. I just like good books.
Well, I know I like good books, but I mean, there are a million books. You have to find areas that are most likely
to be... Well, no, I know, but even when I was trying to think about sci-fi now, and I was like, what have I... I must have actually read sci-fi. And it very quickly becomes apparent that, yes, of course I have, because loads of books... Well... High Rise is SF.
Ballard, yeah.
Yeah, so
well, he would
Ballard.
Be, yeah, but he is an actor.
Doris
sci-fi.
Lessing, I mean, The Cleft, that's sort of in that it's an alternative
world. Oh, old Margaret
world.
Atwood is a bit...
Margaret Atwood. Yeah. Actually, I read Daniel Keyes, which I was very pleased to see starts Robert Irwin's review, because I was like, yes, I have actually really read that one.
Yeah. I was going to say, someone else who is kind of...
Ridley Walker, that's, you know...
Yeah.
Sort of a past and future mishmash.
Yeah. So, but you wouldn't necessarily dive into it and go, I'm now going to spend the next 6 months reading.
I wouldn't, if I were putting my books on shelves, I wouldn't put them all on the same shelf.
No. Okay.
So that's what I'm saying.
Oh, aren't you open-minded? Well done, Thea.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Now, if an alien were to be dropped into Washington, D.C., what would he or she or it make of the politics there? Well, probably not much more than the rest of us. We've got the televised spectacle of an impeachment trial in which the outcome is based not on legality, but on politics, the most powerful man in the country being challenged, but with no sense that he could actually be toppled, and an argument raging that the process will even help him by energising his base without converting any doubters in the other direction. Anyway, let's focus on the legal question. We asked Professor Lawrence Douglas from Amherst College the question, when can you impeach a president? And he's reviewed a couple of books, and his answer is absolutely fascinating. He's on the line now. Lawrence, hello.
Hi.
Let's start with the Constitution, which is where you start. A president can be impeached if he committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So is the first question that's been wrestled with that, are we talking always about crimes? Is that sort of the central question from a legal perspective at stake?
Well, yeah, I mean, you certainly hear, if you've been watching the Senate proceedings, their arguments on both sides, well, high crimes and misdemeanors, the House managers insist, well, that does not actually mean crime in the narrow technical legal sense. Trump's defenders come back and say, no, the language high crimes and misdemeanors means what it sort of sounds like, that actually you do need to have demonstrable evidence of a real crime technically conceived. And so we have to kind of go back and look at it historically. And if you go back and look at it historically, it seems like the answer is pretty clear. Now, do you want that pretty clear answer?
I would like that pretty clear. And I'm proud to say that it comes from the 14th century parliamentary practice in this country.
Yes, indeed it does. In fact, this language of high crimes and misdemeanors, I think, appears for the very first time in an impeachment proceeding all the way back in 1386. And it seems pretty clear that, the Parliament had a kind of long, centuries-long experience with impeaching people. And it seems very clear that the parliamentary process, which supplied the inspiration for the American model, the parliamentary process did not require crimes narrowly conceived or technically conceived, that abuse of office was more than consistent with the language of high crimes and misdemeanors. And it seems pretty clear that the framers of the U.S. Constitution, who simply adopted the language from parliamentary practice, that they thought exactly the same thing. I mean, if you look, for example, in the Federalist Papers, were documents that were written by a handful of framers.
Alexander Hamilton.
Yes, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and John Jay. And if you look at what Alexander Hamilton says in Federalist 65, he says very clearly that abuse of office, that is without any kind of technical crime, suffices to satisfy the condition of high crimes and misdemeanors.
So that's the word misdemeanor doing it. Is that the point, that misdemeanor can conceal a multitude of sins?
Well, it's funny because misdemeanor sounds like, if you think about it from a contemporary legal perspective, like a high misdemeanor or misdemeanors are things like jaywalking. So you don't usually think of jaywalking as something that would then justify the removal of a president of the United States. So I think it reminds us that this language has a long, long history, and you can't simply try to insert contemporary understandings of what the terms mean in order to parse the constitutional language.
But, I mean, roughly speaking, what we're saying is that it was a moral crime. So, you know, acting irresponsibly or in a way that was not becoming of your place in office. So it's a much more nebulous thing to define, to pinpoint and say that is incorrect behaviour.
Yeah, in fact, it seems pretty clear that the framers of the Constitution, in borrowing the English language, they really meant to have kind of a placeholder for all sorts of behaviour that was tantamount to either reckless behaviour in office, gross negligence in office, abuse of the office, but basically for behavior that demonstrated that the incumbent was unfit for the presidency.
And if that were the case, if we were taking it at its broadest, then it would seem that you'd be very hard-pitched to say that Donald Trump shouldn't be convicted. Because if it's at the state of recklessness, if it's acts unbecoming to an office, if it's inappropriate conduct, inappropriate
or
words...
Alexander Hamilton's formulation, an abuse or violation of some public trust, and we're talking about public funds specifically, aren't we?
But even in its broadest, just his general conduct feels like it would be impeachable, wouldn't it, by that standard?
That's true, even though, again, I think it's probably right for... I mean, given the fact that impeachment is what we might say is a pretty radical stopgap, I mean, this is something that you are ultimately overturning the outcome of a democratic election, that we probably want to hold it to a somewhat higher threshold. So maybe if we're talking about abuse of office, we want to kind of insert some kind of egregiousness standard. Yeah. Now, I think probably it is fair to say that Donald Trump has acted pretty egregiously from day one. But nevertheless, I do think it was probably wise on the part of the House Democrats to wait until that egregiousness standard was really satisfied by his behavior with respect to Ukraine. Of course, it seems very likely that nothing particularly good is going to come from this impeachment.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment because I think that's fascinating. Is one version of events with your legal perspective that if this were to be a definable crime versus an egregious abuse of office which has a sort of moral weight, if it were the former, is it your view that Donald Trump has a credible defence but he doesn't in the latter? Is it as straightforward as that?
I think that's pretty fair to say. I mean, I guess the General Accounting Office concluded that he had engaged in, that he basically had broken a law. They'd engaged in an illegal act in withholding the congressionally authorized funds to the Ukraine, the $391 million. But they never said that he committed a crime. I mean, we have to remember that there's a difference between illegal acts and criminal acts.
Yeah.
And so there's no real allegation right now that he's engaged in kind of criminal behavior. So to the extent that, I mean, which is another one of the reasons why his defenders want to insist that the language in the Constitution requires the demonstration of criminal behavior rather than just bad or stupid behavior.
Yeah. One of the books that you review in your pieces impeaches the trial of Andrew Johnson and the dream of a just nation. How enlightening is it to compare Trump's case with that case from 1868?
Well, what's interesting is how little we learned from history in a certain way, because a lot of these questions that are being debated right now are exactly the same questions that were debated back in 1868. So you had the same kind of argument as to how high crimes and misdemeanors actually mean. On a kind of deeper level, I suppose, the impeachment proceeding brought against Andrew Johnson, it does look a little bit like the impeachment proceeding against Trump in the following sense. The House basically kind of used Johnson's technical violation of a law as an occasion to impeach him, when really what was at issue was his kind of larger abuse of the office with respect to trying to frustrate the Republicans from creating an ambitious reconstruction program for the South in the wake of the Civil War. I mean, Johnson's position was very much that the South lost, okay, but they can reconstruct their society almost exclusively along antebellum terms, leaving freed blacks in horrendous conditions. And that basically was kind of his impeachment was almost kind of a referendum about this larger vision of what the country should look like.
Which is a connection with Trump again. That again, if we were to take this at its broadest, the same thing could be said about Johnson as could be said about Trump. There's lots of things he did, the way he spoke. You talk about his swaggering vanity, his taste for public performance, his bullying, his disregard for minorities. Many people would put those claims directly on Trump. And some would argue that this impeachment, like Johnson's, is a technical way of judging him for all sorts of things that aren't necessarily under the terms of the law itself.
Yes, precisely. Exactly. And again, I think in the piece I tried to point out that we shouldn't belabor the similarities between Johnson and Trump. But it certainly is true that Johnson was an incredibly thin-skinned person who went after his enemies, who there are all sorts of ways in which you can draw personal similarities between the two.
You do it very nicely, I think, Lawrence. It's very nicely done in the piece.
A crucial difference, Johnson was an autodidact with a lifelong passion for reading. Yeah. Book's not
yes,
about
exactly.
himself.
Yeah. That's right. He actually read a book, so yeah. That is a difference.
Although there is an irony that I saw brought out that Trump may be brought down by John Bolton's book. Mm. So it'd be funny if a book were to bring Trump down, the lifelong non-reader gets destroyed by a book. There's something ironic in this. I don't want to offend you, Lawrence, but I'm going to say this to you. Does all of this not show that the law, and even a sense of law, makes no difference when it comes to the hearts of the American state? Because Andrew Johnson won. He was impeached, but he wasn't convicted, probably because he bribed several people to vote his way. It is almost certainly the case that Donald Trump is not going to be convicted because partisanship is going to dictate that you need a two-third majority and it's not going to happen. Does this in some ways make a mockery of the sense of legality at the heart of the state? Because actually the law and a just opinion, that makes no difference.
I am deeply offended. No, I'm kidding. I'm not deeply offended. But, I think one of the points that you're making, it actually kind of goes to the heart of the difficulty in really making sense of the impeachment process. Because on one level, the way you were characterizing it, you're treating the impeachment process as a kind of quintessentially legal process. And if you think of it as a legal process that is meant to render justice conventionally conceived, then yes, it does look like we're kind of making a mockery of that. On the other hand, inasmuch as the impeachment process is directed towards removing someone from the presidency, not from imposing any kind of criminal penalty, you can say that it really is kind of a political process as much as it is judicial or legal.
Yeah.
And once you introduce politics into a process, then you can't necessarily accuse it of kind of you can't then measure it by the same standards that you would measure, let's say, a criminal trial.
Why dress it up as a criminal trial? I mean, the parallel that strikes me in this country, in Britain, you can vote of no confidence a government. And that ultimately, although there were some complications in the last 2 years, to say the very least, but theoretically, a vote of no confidence can bring down a government. And you don't have to dress it up with, have they done something that's a high crime and misdemeanor? You just say, we don't believe this is government functioning. And that's therefore pure politics, because it's actually in the realm of the functioning government. Is this a problem that you're trying to do that in America, but dressing it up in some of the robes of the legal system?
I think that's a terrific point, because there are a lot of people who say that, one of the problems with this is, you can say it's part of the problem is the hyper-partisanship of politics in America today. But you can also say part of the problem is with the constitutional design itself. I mean, after all, we're talking about a document that was drafted in 1787.
You've got a book coming out called brilliantly titled Will He Go? Trump and Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. What's the political consequence? So you're good on the law, but you're good on the politics as well. What's the political consequences of this process? Some of the Democratic candidates, of course, in their primary are stuck in the Senate, so they're trying Trump, so they're not out on the campaign trail. That's not true of Biden, for example. Some people believe that Trump facing this impeachment, this is good for him because it energizes his base. What do you think the political outcome of this will be on the basis, presumably, that you don't think he'll be convicted?
I think part of it has to do with whether Bolton testifies. I think if it were the case that the trial was able to end very quickly with the expected acquittal, then it's possible that Trump could come away from this actually so much stronger. I think a very deeply, deeply, deeply unfortunate outcome. I do think, though, if Bolton comes and testifies and the process drags out, even though the result will remain inevitably that he'll be acquitted, that at least to the independent voters out there, ultimately the process could have some kind of positive effect if it weakens Trump's candidacy in 2020.
And that, again, would be the Andrew Johnson effect, because that's effectively what happened there, isn't it? He stayed on for a year, but it was a weak one.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So even though Johnson was acquitted by that single vote in the Senate, he was a very weakened president. And in fact, he failed to even capture the nomination of his party for the next presidential election. So it's not even that he lost in a national election. He wasn't even the party's candidate.
I remember talking to some Republicans last year where they were talking tough, potentially because they were embarrassed by Trump, I think, when they said, oh, maybe we should primary Trump and see if we can put a Republican candidate against him. But they're not going to do that, are they? That Trump is the Republican candidate for 2020.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of shocking the degree to which Trump is able to capture the entire Republican Party and to kind of turn it into a mirror of himself. You know, you have people
hideous
like
image. Nick.
Yes, absolutely. No, it's just quite shocking.
We had a piece by Andrew Sullivan, who's a conservative commentator, and I just wonder whether this is the theme of your book, Lawrence, which is that he said he could perfectly believe Trump loses a close election, refuses to recognise the validity of it. He's got a lot of quite militant people who might start standing on certain states' rights or perceived rights and say they don't accept the judgment of the electorate. Is that the thrust of what you're saying, that this is not entirely straightforward, that there's a clean election coming?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, that's basically kind of the focus of my book. I mean, one of the things that everyone assumes is that, well, the election is the kind of the proper way. I mean, even people who maybe question his fitness in office, but doubt the propriety of removing him through an impeachment proceeding, say like, well, let the people decide in 2020. Well, that assumes that, well, first of all, it presupposes that he's going to lose. And basically, my book tries to argue that if it's a close election or election in which the result can be contested, that Trump is not going to concede. And actually, kind of the main thrust of my book, which might be a little bit different from what Andrew Sullivan was suggesting, is that if you look at the kind of the laws that we have in place in the United States to deal with an election that becomes very problematic, these laws provide no bulwark whatsoever from stopping a rogue president from trying to stay in office. I mean, it's kind of shocking how poorly equipped we are to deal with electoral crisis in this country.
And you'd accept the argument that this could lead to civil unrest, because you could have someone who is known for demagoguery and whipping up a base saying, I'm not going anywhere. And then you have a potentially very volatile situation.
Yes. I mean, there are more guns in the United States than there are people. And or roughly one to one, and I would imagine that a lot of those guns are concentrated in the hands of people who are fervent supporters of Donald Trump. But you know, we don't even necessarily have to imagine a civil war scenario to imagine an election that just turns into kind of a hideous meltdown. And again, a lot of it has to do with the way in which our law is ill-equipped to deal with narrowly contested. I mean, if you slot Donald Trump into the place of Al Gore in 2000, recall that there was this incredibly tight election result in 2000 between Al Gore and George W. Bush. You slot Donald Trump in the position of Al Gore, and you have a complete election meltdown in the United States.
The consequences of that cannot fully be predicted. I mean, in a funny way, we've had a bit of an experiment in this country where we had a narrowly contested referendum, which was not our normal way of going about business. And it's taken us 3 years and an awful lot of angst and awfulness to get to a position where the 52% verdict is being upheld, and on Friday, when we're recording this, on Friday, we are going to Brexit. But that's 3 years in a slightly more, I suspect, pacific country in the way we do our politics, Britain. Then that's probably a bit of an analogous situation, isn't it? That this was what happens when something is so closely contested? What happens to the losers?
That's exactly right. I mean, though, on the other hand, I mean, you're talking about how to engineer a political response to a kind of a national referendum. I mean, we couldn't afford to have 3 years in which we can't figure out who the president of the United States is. I mean, that's a particularly dangerous situation. We don't want to think about that one.
Yeah, well, it might be better than the previous 3 years. So maybe a cynic would argue.
Right. Well, I guess it depends who's occupying the acting presidency.
Yeah, that's very true. Lawrence, what a great pleasure it is to talk to you. I'm sure we'd love to talk to you again as the year progresses.
I very much enjoy that.
Thank you so much, Lawrence Douglas, there.
We When Ezra Pound said literature is news that stays news, he couldn't possibly have foreseen that 1,000-plus love letters written to one Emily Hale between 1930 and 1956 by his erstwhile protégé and later friend, the poet T.S. Eliot, would be big, big news in 2020. Our poetry editor Alan Jenkins came on this show a few weeks ago to fill us in, but if you missed that, here's a quick recap. In 1956, Emily Hale, a teacher and amateur actor with whom Eliot had fallen in love while a student at Harvard in the early 1910s, bequeathed letters Eliot had written to her over a 20-odd year period to Princeton University Library. It was agreed, at Eliot's behest, that the file would remain sealed until 50 years after the death of whichever one of the couple died last. In the meantime, Eliot burned all the letters in his own possession. After Hale died in 1969, the clock started ticking, and now here we are. The gates have opened. We have plenty of questions. What really was the nature of Hale and Eliot's relationship? Why did they never marry, when all indications were that they would and should? What was Eliot trying to achieve in the weird and clunky statement written in the 60s and released shortly after this archive was made public? Like many scholars, Hannah Sullivan has long been fascinated by the content of these letters and was only too eager to take a trip to Princeton. And while we can't pretend that we'll be able to answer all those questions on this podcast, this is very much a developing news story. Hannah joins us on the line now to take tentative steps in that direction. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, hi. Thank you for having me.
Your interest in these letters dates back 20-odd years. What did it feel like to you to finally, you know, hold them in your hands? What were they like to read?
That was pretty peculiar. I could have used digital copies, it turned out, afterwards, and some of the other researchers in the library were, because it's easier to go through lots of material at once, but that didn't occur to me. So I just had the real thing. So I'd never, in fact, held any of Eliot's letters. So there was a certain fascination in that alone. The paper was very thin. A lot of the letters, especially from the late 40s when I was reading, were airmail paper. Most of them were typed with the appellation and the signature I hand. So he writes, you know, dearest Emily or my dear, or I think the most passionate one was the Emily in whom Tom lives. Wow. And that letter's signed off, the new Emily Tom, hyphenated, as if he's become a kind of composite person.
Does it feel strange reading love? I mean, just because it's such a staple of the biographer's trade, and you know, there's an argument about how that will be now in the modern world, but certainly for the period we're talking about, does it feel strange when you're eavesdropping on a love affair?
Yeah, of course, and I think particularly strange in the case of Eliot, because the persona revealed in the letters is really quite different from, you know, the one that we've seen really in any of the other letters, I think, or any of the other material that I'm familiar with. And I guess, I mean, all literary texts do have an ideal reader, maybe even an inscribed reader, but letters do have that in a very clear sense. These letters, you know, as his note makes clear, are for Emily's eyes only, at least until the very end. There was one that spooked me out at the very end of the correspondence where he says, sort of directly to whichever eye looks at the letters first at some future date, I should like it to fall on this letter first, and then to Emily, if you will add it. I don't think, I certainly wasn't the first eye, but I guess I was one of the first, perhaps, to have a look at that one.
Well, that is creepy. Why did you begin your research in 1947? As I said in the introduction, that they started corresponding in the 30s.
I mean, I think even to call it my research would be almost exaggerating it. I was in New York. My book was coming out in the States, and I in the end only had one full day to spend there. So 47 was sort of an economical way to cut to the chase. I had also not been sure how busy the library would be, and I thought it might be the case that all the boxes for the 30s had been taken out by other people.
It is a pivotal year.
Right, no, exactly. But the significance of 1947 as a sort of economical route to what happened is that Vivian Eliot's first wife, died quite suddenly, unexpectedly, in January. And so I realised that it will be in the early letters of that year that Eliot had the task, first of all, of telling Emily that, I mean, he has to write a letter to let her know, and secondly, working out what was going to happen with the relationship once she died. And I was quite fascinated by the suggestion in that note that the Harvard Library released. It was a kind of sudden enlightenment, you know, that he realised instantly that when Vivian died, that he didn't want to marry Emily, having not realised that, or even having thought that he might want to for the previous 17 years.
What happened? What changed? I mean, how did he go from, so, you know, they were so sort of set, that would have been their moment, and yet?
I mean, that's a little bit hard to say. I didn't read the letters from the war years when they didn't see each other. He'd been in 1946. I wish very much I'd read the letters from the summer of 1946. You know, those letters from February, March, you know, on into April 1947, incredibly painful to read, partly because the news comes out quite slowly in some ways, but also because he doesn't really seem to know himself. he keeps referring to her confusion about his duality. He doesn't like using that word, or his recantation. He pretends to believe she's talking about his lectures on Milton. But he keeps saying, in language that's actually quite philosophical, that this is the problem with knowledge derived from experience. You know, that's what his PhD dissertation had been on decades earlier, that it's only valuable for the experiences that you've already had, that when something new happens, like this particular death, you don't feel the way you expect to. He talks at some points as if the violent change in him, the division even that was produced in 1915 by marrying Vivian, kind of comes to an end, so that there's some period of time that stretches in his life from 1915 to 47, and that Vivian's death seals that off. And he keeps saying, and Emily obviously found this very hurtful, because he refers in some of the letters to her, you know, somewhat angry responses, that he's a new man, he's kind of a ghost, he's a figure that she's not seen before, that when he comes to Cambridge in May, she'll be seeing someone who's essentially a new person.
Well, he says a great deal of myself was dead when Vivian died.
These are extremely well written. They're obviously, he talks about the difficulty of writing them, how he has to kind of wait to after lunch, you know, really think about what he's saying. There are some very elaborate metaphors, including this one about a mummy, where he says, you know, is that old story true? That a body is preserved exactly as it was at the moment of death until the mummy is opened, and then instantly the flesh all crumbles away and all that you're left with is bones. I mean, for a woman who was waiting perhaps for a marriage proposal, or at least for some of the sort of sexy, tender, exciting, excitable language of those letters from the 30s, you know, this kind of funereal, ghostly, hallucinated language, I imagine, would be incredibly painful.
Was he incapable? I mean, it strikes me when I'm listening to you talk about this, that this is someone who is actually incapable of rendering his feelings into very clear, short statements. It sounds that this has a lot in common with his critical writings. You know, they're very involved, they're very cerebral, they're almost unwilling to touch at the sort of the throbbing nerve of what is actually going on. For love letters, they seem peculiarly like the way you're describing them as sort of critical statements.
That's a little bit hard to say, I think. I mean, the prose style of that period is somewhat different, perhaps more elaborate than we're used to. Some of the letters from the 30s, I didn't see very many of those. The middle 30s do have short sentences in, you know, short sentences of excitement or declaration. But I think you're right that, you know, from the early 1910s onwards, from Prufrock, Eliot's poetry too is approaching a very revisionary syntax. You know, Prufrock replays these indecisions, the revisions.
Yeah.
And I think that's true here as well, that he's in some ways trying to be scrupulously honest about what he feels, but the project of being honest is a difficult one, and it requires, you know, a simple statement can't be made. It's not just enough to say, I suddenly realized that I didn't want to marry you after all, or that I had no interest in sex. He's got to try to work out why that's happened.
It must be so frustrating that, I mean, like you say, that not only at the level of, this is not the message I want to be hearing because I thought we had something, but also at the level of, you're cloaking what you're saying in not quite euphemism, but it's being dressed up in a way that must be frustrating for the person who's trying to read it and decode it.
Yes, it would be very interesting, wouldn't it, to read her responses. I mean, he didn't destroy them immediately when she donated the letters. I think it's only in 1963, so after his second marriage has gone on for a few years before he decided to burn them. I suspect that a lot of her letters did say, I don't follow, I don't understand, because a lot of his language picks up on that point. And so I think he does try to be clearer, but basically he's explaining it to her for 2 years. You know, even in 1949 he writes a letter saying, I think I understand a little bit better now, the thing that was a tremendous shock to me, you know, it's taken me 2 years. He says, there's not been a single day in the last 2 years when I haven't thought with pain about this situation, about you, and about the situation of us together.
It's also this weird extended riff on the whole you know, it's not you, it's me sort of thing. You say the worst part, he says, you will think it is something personal to yourself, you know, but it isn't.
That's tough, isn't it? I mean, she, of course, he hadn't seen her for a number of years during the war. He saw her in the summer of 46. I mean, by then she was a woman in her mid-50s. When this second phase of the relationship, it was already a second phase, began, she was in her late 30s. That photo that I think you're running, you know, in the paper together with the article, was taken in the summer of 46. I mean, she looks like a, you know, prim, middle-aged, even verging on elderly woman.
Yeah.
I'm sure she must have been aware of these sorts of changes in her own body and appearance. The letters from the 30s are quite physical, but more so, I think, than this Harvard statement would lead you to expect. And he talks about her bathing costume, about her permanent wave, about how he wants to, you know, put his face into her hair. It was not a relationship, even if it wasn't consummated, that was without, you know, a sexual and physical.
Well, he says very defensively, as you put it, sort of Clintonian fashion. I might mention at this point that I never at any time had and sexual relations with Emily Hale, which suggests
I think that line was revised. Well, he mistyped it. He wrote "and," and like he meant "any." The typing in that note is quite poor throughout, which is unlike the letters themselves, which are carefully typed, except for occasionally when he uses a new typewriter. I think that suggests that perhaps he didn't have a great time writing it. And I think I don't quite want to say it's perjury, but I think that that statement he would have realized was not entirely true, and that perhaps I'm sure they probably never did consummate the relationship. Probably, although they might have done, and evidence might yet reveal that. I mean, only one piece of positive evidence would be enough, but there's a lot of stuff about the difficulty of navigating an American summer hotel, about how they want to have a lot of privacy, to make you think that it was certainly not a relationship that, even on the surface to other people, you know, had the complete semblance of propriety. And Emily's note, which now has also been released but didn't get as much attention, that's one of the sort of ironies of the whole story, you know, it does say that both friends of hers and of his, a small number, but some of them, knew that their intention was essentially to marry each other from the 30s onwards.
What we really need to ask is, do these letters change the poems? I mean, the way we should read them?
Yeah, I think they do. I think it wouldn't be too much. And I've read, you know, I have to emphasize again, a very small proportion. I mean, probably less than 10%. Not just that they change our reading of Eliot's poems, but of his thought, of mid-century thought, and probably of modernism in general. I mean, already Francis Dickey, who is an Eliot scholar, a former president of the Eliot Society, has found a letter from James Joyce, because one of Eliot's habits was having enclosures in the letters. You know, he was almost like, at points it's quite sweet that he sort of wants to show off about his successes in his career and about the people that he knows. And that's a really interesting letter, from what I've been able to tell, about politics, that's from the 30s and a letter that wasn't known before. But as far as Eliot's own poems go, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Rix and McHugh edition is going to need quite substantial revision. It looks as if all of the poems from the 30s, at least under some light, are for Emily, and that she might be regarded as the central figure in them. So Burnt Norton, the first of the four quartets, the one from which the others develop, I think is not only about going to Burnt Norton, you know, a house that's burnt down, any gardens left, with Emily, but it is about the relationship. It's about a relationship that has at its heart, you know, a central absence. And I also think some of the language in four quartets about the problems using words, which critics have often found really banal and sort of sententious, makes more sense, is closer to personal feeling when you look at passages in the letters.
And just finally, do you think of him differently, Hannah? Because you'll have spent a lot of your professional life thinking of him and considering his work. Do you think of T.S. Eliot, the man, differently now?
Well, I do and I don't. To be honest, I thought the letters were going to be like this. I didn't think that they were just going to be, you know, discussions of her plays or kind of dry academic conversation, because his is a character that is so obviously constructed around repression, and that, you know, there is this very romantic side of him, which is, you know, he refers to that in tradition and the individual talent, you know, that only personalities who have these things, emotions and personality, know all of this or need all of this, need to repress them in certain ways. So in a way, it wasn't surprising. But it also was surprising, you know, the language, the incredibly adolescent, in a way, tone of those early letters, you know, the excitement, the kind of unguarded excitement.
Does it humanise him a bit more?
Totally humanises him. I mean, not just because of the romantic material, but he's petulant, he's gossipy, he gets grumpy when she says that he's mean because he hasn't phoned her and says, you know, you needn't have thought it was about the money. He says things about his family, about, you know, other writers, about even getting the Nobel Prize, that something that most of us haven't, you know, can't really empathise with as a problem, that are very humanising, yeah.
It's a fascinating piece you've written, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Bye.
Hannah mentioned James Joyce. Have you ever read, this is me lowering the tone, I just want to flag that up in advance, have you read James Joyce's letters to his wife?
I haven't, no.
The sex letters.
Oh, I've heard, yes.
They are absolutely extraordinary.
That's not surprising.
It's not at all surprising. But even within the context of what you think, if you Google James Joyce Nora, I think it's Nora, isn't it?
I'm worried.
Yeah, sex letters. Letters sex. Respectable, you know, it is safe for work. Respectable organs, if I may use the term, have written about them. All I'm saying is they are extraordinary.
Okay.
I'll leave it, say no more than that, but it's definitely worth checking out. Your mind will be boggled.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cue nervous laughter.
Yeah. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Hannah Sullivan, Lawrence Douglas, and of course to Lucy Dallas. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. This week, Mary Beard goes to Davos. Yep, the mind is boggling there as well. Plus, we look in homage to Thea. I actually thought of you as I was putting these pages together. Spaghetti Westerns.
Oh, okay.
The Italian crime novel.
Yep.
Fascism.
Yeah.
Last one, less so, but there was an Italian.
It's uneasily.
Yeah, yeah. Understand. Yeah, but there was an Italian. There's an Italian mini theme.
Yes.
In tribute to you, dear. Next week we're not going to Italy. We're going to Russia, which should be lovely. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.